Welcome to Men Are the Prize, the podcast. It is me, Harvey, your host. How you doing? How you feeling today? I hope you're doing well. If you're listening to this on a Saturday when it's dropped, I hope the week is good. I hope you're about to enjoy this day and find a way to do a little something for yourself over the weekend. I have another great guest. This season has been fantastic. I've had different men talking about different subjects. It's been a plethora, a little bit of everything, which I love, and I have a great guest today. I've been posting on social media as we record this, and I always like to reach out to the men and talk to you men about how you express yourself, how we deal with life. And today, I posted about make room. That was the thing I spoke about. And what I mean by that is in life, in business, in relationships, in anything we do, you need to be represented. If you are in a marriage, you need to make room for you, how you want to be loved, how you want to be respected. What do you enjoy? What do you want to do? Because a lot of times as husbands, we tend to cater to our spouse and don't always get catered to. So you got to make sure that if you're going to be in this marriage, you need to be happy. And to be happy, you need to be taken care of. So keep that in mind. But I also talk to business people, and business is hard work. It's time consuming. It takes over your life to a degree. It takes you away from your family. But if you're going to do something like that, it is imperative that the business that is taking you away from other things, it's got to have you imprinted in it. This is your business. This is what you want to do. If you're going to take time away from family, then you better be doing it for the right reason. This is your business. This has to cater to your morals, your ideals, things that you think are important. Your fingerprints should be all over the business. So make room for yourself. Make sure that when I look at your business and anybody looks at your business, that they can see you in it. And when that happens, you'll do well. You'll succeed because it's not just business. And it's not just a relationship. It is your business. It's your relationship. It's your marriage. It's your relationship with your kids, your parents, whomever. Make room for yourself in anything that you do that's important. So just keep that in mind. With that said, I'm just going to bring in my guest. I'm really excited about this one. I love a good conversation with a man. But of course, give me a black man. I'm good. Let's talk to Justin T. Hall. How are you doing today, sir?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much. If you are a watcher or a listener, if you know the next step is my favorite part. It's the bio. I love reading a good bio. It's always good to read about what somebody's done. And in every case, this is just the beginning. There's more to come. So I'm reading like the first few chapters of somebody's journey, about somebody's life. This is just the start. Let's read it. Justin T. Hall, entrepreneur, author, speaker, storyteller, vitiligo ambassador, and advocate. He is passionate about helping others not only succeed in business, but truly succeed in life. He has had the opportunity to talk to people of all ages across the nation as an assembly speaker on the topics of bullying prevention and peer acceptance. From that experience, Justin authored Aiden Spots, a book that raises awareness about vitiligo using language that even a young child can understand. Additionally, this book focuses on inclusion and self-confidence, serving as a much-needed reminder we are all facing struggles in life and all need love and acceptance. His second children's book on vitiligo, Daddy's Skin, is set for release spring of 2024. I read bios because we typically don't get to hear our accolades. So what's it like hearing what you've done so far, Justin?
It's good, but just a reminder that, I have so much more to accomplish. I still have a lot of work to do. You know, hearing that's great, but thinking about what the overall vision is, you know, it just reminds me that still a lot of work to be done. I'm not there yet.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. I like I said, we men don't always get to hear it. And you should always take pride in your successes so far. You should take pride in what you've done currently. But that really should motivate you to be looking way far ahead. What am I about to accomplish? What's the big thing that's about to go down? What's about to happen tomorrow?
Yeah.
Do you people know what's coming? I mean, do I know what's coming? You know, this. So I think it's motivation, but it's also also smell the roses too.
Yeah.
So I like to do both. So I'm glad that you heard that, but I know in 5 years or so, I'll be like, Justin, he was on my podcast. He was a little stuff. Now I can't even reach out to Justin. He too big for me. Oh, so I caught you early, brother.
That won't be the case. But when I'm back in 5 years, then we can switch up the bio a little bit.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm going to have you fill that out again. It'll be longer, or it'll be shorter with bigger, big wins. That's what's up. I like that. I agree with you. I like that. If you are a new watcher slash listener to this podcast, this is a space for men to be open, vulnerable, emotional. We're talking. It's a conversation. We don't do this enough. We need to do it more. That's why I created this podcast. That's why I created this space. And I want you to hear other men comfortable talking about what they're doing, their lives, their successes, failures, ins, outs, all that stuff. That's what this is. So and it's not that I don't actually care about what Justin is saying. I do, but I'm more interested in the fact that he's opening his mouth and he's talking, because we don't do that as enough as men. So the story is great, but the action of talking is what I love. So I'm glad we're going to get to do this. But like I said, if this is the first episode, you picked a good one. Yes. Me and Justin about to chop it up. We're going to have a good conversation. I use the word prize. Four of the letters in the word prize represent characteristics that I think are good for men. The first letter is P. The word is purpose. And purpose is defined as reason for which something is done or created, or for which something exists. So, Justin, what is your purpose?
My purpose, I think it could change, because it as I grow and develop it, it does change. But right now, I would say my purpose is to help enough other people reach their desires, reach their passions, their goals, their dreams. If I can, I know if I help enough other people, then I'm definitely going to reach all of mine. So I think it's to help enough other people reach their goals and visions, and be here to take care of my family. And I don't want to say, I always hear people say, oh, I gotta break generational curses. I don't know if we have that, but I want to be the change in my family, and be able to show not only my family but everybody I know and people that I don't know that it's possible. You can do whatever you want to do on this planet. So I want to show people that, don't dream small, dream big, because you can do whatever you want. And too many times, I don't think we as just people or just the human race realize that you can do whatever you want on this planet.
So if you're here to help people, my question would be, why don't people reach for their goals? Why do we dream small? What's kind of holding us back right now?
A lot of it is what we've been, a lot of us have been brainwashed, what we've been told by others. And normally that's a reflection of what life has taught them to that point, and they're reflecting it on you. Or just sometimes you can't dream big because you don't even know that dream exists. If no one ever went to college and left your community or left your state, you may not even know that exists within your own family or within your own community. So a lot of the time you don't know what you don't know. So a lot of the times dreaming big has to do with that. Or, there's issues within yourself. Maybe you don't feel worthy. I don't feel worthy of having the career I'm on, or I don't feel worthy of having the big house, or there's a lot of guilt attached to that. And the breaking that generational curse is comes along getting rid of some of that guilt. 'Cause especially if you're someone of color and you start your business or you're working hard within your career and you feel guilty about, asking for more or wanting more, because you're like, wow, I'm already doing so much better than everybody I know. And there's some guilt attached to that. and that keeps us from dreaming big or going bigger, because you already feel a little bit guilty. Well, I'm already making double the salary that my parents ever made their whole lifetime. So, you know, why am I asking for more? And other people don't, that guilt is not associated with their thinking, right, or their feelings. They know they can do, they know sky's the limit. And like Chris Rock says, when you're Black, you just think the limit's the sky. So, you know, you have to first know that. And like I said, if you don't know what you don't know, but then once you do realize there's more, you have to get rid of that guilt and that shame that, you know, that sometimes is associated with that, because others aren't feeling that.
Right. You're right. Do you remember what your first big dream was?
I think I wanted to be a comedian, a stand-up comedian. And this just goes to not following things. And so, you know, my mother would allow me to stay up and watch the Johnny Carson monologue. But as soon as the monologue was over, I had to go to bed. So
okay.
11:37, and not every night, but some nights she would allow me. And so then the next day at school, I would repeat those jokes. And some of them I didn't understand. Some I kind of understood. And I would get, and you know, it was weird. I was never after a laugh from other kids. I was after a laugh from teachers.
Right.
So I was like, oh, if I can break them, then maybe I'm funny. And so that was my dream. I was like, oh, I want to be a comedian. I want to host Saturday Night Live or be a cast member. And that was the biggest dream. And somewhere along the line, that died. Well, that kind of morphed. Then I got a basketball Jones and played basketball in high school and college and wanted to take that as far as it could go. And, you know, I did and had some unfortunate injuries that kind of ended that dream. But so it's weird. So after all of that, I said, you know what, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to get a good job. I'm going to be a company man, because, you know, that's what I heard all my life. You know, go to, you know, I was fortunate. My mother was a, you know, 35-year public school teacher, but, you know, college educated. Her parents went to college. So it wasn't unheard of. And I saw that. But they also, you know, said, find somewhere you can get a pension. My goal was to get a job and work there. And actually, my first job, I worked there for like 10 years, started out in a warehouse and in college and worked my way up to a project manager. And so I said, maybe I can just do that. But then I started, you know, realizing that you were expendable. So from that job, I realized I was severely underpaid. And probably because I had just been there and worked up the ranks and, you know, and so I realized there was a whole other world out there where I could be a project manager and make double, triple salary I was making. So I got other jobs. And unfortunately, this is around like 2008. So mm-hmm. I happened to be in the job market in the biggest recession in the last 50 years. And so I lost several jobs. I had companies where I showed up and there was chains on the doors because they had gone bankrupt. So for about 5 years, from 2008 to 2012 or so, I was at a company for a year. They would downsize, go out of business. Luckily, I was able to usually find something else. And around that time, I had some friends that were wanted to be in the entertainment business and said, you know, could you manage us or help us? So I started helping them just kind of on the side. And I had a friend from college that since I've met him, his goal was to be a director. And he's like, I'm going to direct movies one day. And so in managing my friends, I kind of brought him on and we shot a whole bunch of music videos for not only people I was working with, but for other artists here in Atlanta. And he actually moved to Atlanta. And the thing, even to this day, that I admired about him is he's not relenting his dream. He's like, if I got to starve or do whatever, I'm going to do it. And so he and I opened up a production studio. So I was still working full time in order to pay the bills. And so we opened up a studio here. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, still am in Atlanta. And we had psych walls and green screens. This is before the huge Tyler Perry, the last three studios. This is, I think, PCE. This is before Pinewood, Paramount for the big film boom in Atlanta. And I had 18,000 square feet of studio space. So we shot a ton of music videos. We were the only affordable green screen. If you wanted to put a boat or an army tank or a car, we had that. And we built it all out. You know, fortunately, we were in a bad real estate deal. We were leasing this building. It was an old warehouse. And if you're familiar with Atlanta, it was off Sylvan Road, Capitol Heights area, where it was still dangerous at that time. And so I was maybe paying $1,200 a month for this huge space because they thought they didn't know what I was going to do with it. And then once they realized, and I think I put not a lot of money now that I know, but when you're working full-time with lobbying, maybe like 60 grand into the building and the build out. And when they realized what I was doing, they're like, oh, why are we charging you $1,200? So when my lease was up, they're like, great, we want to have you back. However, the lease is now $10,000 a month. And so what they were doing, unbeknownst to me too, is they were advertising this space with all of the amenities I was doing with the music videos and with the, we did a lot of like industrials or corporate training videos. So whatever needed film we were doing. So not only would we rent the space, but we would also shoot things as needed as well. So they were taking all that and building a portfolio, and the landlord is shopping this to like Los Angeles saying, hey, you want to come to Atlanta for the tax break? I got 18,000 square foot studio for purchase or for lease. And so that increase of rent that I could not jump to at that time, he found people willing to, and essentially, and you know, I don't know what other states, but with Georgia, when you put the amenities you put into a building, even if you're leasing it, when your lease is out, they have to remain there. So, so a lot of the stuff I built out was there. So that was a huge learning lesson, and you know, a little bit hurtful because by that point I had poured everything to it. I'd given up my house. I'd given up everything. I was living in the studio just to, you know, whatever I could pour into that. And so I learned a lot of lessons. I learned to, we had kept it to under wraps because I wanted it to look perfect. I wanted it to look like Hollywood before I reached out. But and this is kind of the birth of social media. I think Facebook was out of time. I should have been telling my story. I should have been capturing along. I should have had behind the scenes. Hey, we're adding floors today. Hey, today I'm building out this psych wall. I didn't even know I could build stuff until I started doing that. Hey, I'm laying floors. I'm adding televisions. I should have been telling my story along to get people interested. And instead, people that were in an industry that we knew were using there, but because half the building was still being done and we were a work in progress, I didn't want to tell everybody. I kept a lot of it off the website. And so that was a big lesson. So people would come in and be like, this is amazing. Why does no one know about this? Why aren't you telling your story? Why aren't you sharing? Why isn't there a newsletter? Why isn't there, you know, Facebook post on this or Twitter? I think Twitter was out too, Twitter and Facebook. Why does no one know about this? Why is your website not bigger? Why aren't you having it on billboards? So I learned from that. And that was at the time a hard pill to swallow, but you know, learned from that. So essentially after that, I went back into the job force, you know, as a PM, and still, but that taught me that I didn't want to be a company man. I didn't want to work somewhere 25 years and get a gold watch and get 40% of my salary as a pension for the rest of my life. So that was the biggest lesson too, that it taught me that, you know, I didn't want to do this, and I was kind of miserable doing that, being a part of the 9-to-5. That, you know, I've always worked hard. I've worked 2-3 jobs at a time. I was working full time with the studio to keep the lights on. But I realized that I had passion. I was passionate about other things than just going to work for somebody else doing the same monotonous thing every day. And there's a lot. And what I also learned, there's a lot of guilt that comes along that I felt really guilty for wanting more than that. I was like, you know, if this was good enough for everybody in my family, my mother worked at the same school for 30 plus years and retired after 40 years of education and never complained, never took a day off, never took a sick day. And so I'm like, man, but I hate going to a job that gives me good, you know, medical and good benefits and decent salary. And really, I could have really lived the true Atlanta life, could have had a nice condo in the city, could have did all this, but that, I mean, those things interest me, but not with working that. I really wanted to, you know, work for myself.
Okay. Hey. Yeah. When you're a person of color, and there's a real difference in how we are raised and how we want to live our lives. And for us, succeeding doesn't always mean excelling, meaning really, really, really going and getting it. It's just being better than the people before us. Because for a lot of us, just surviving is the key.
That's
the thing. That's why we don't have generational wealth, why we don't pass down the house to our kids and whatever, because in a lot of cases, we don't have the house. And then our kid is the next one who gets the house. And then we have so much more. Just living, surviving is the key. While, and it's true, when you're white and in this country, your family, you went to college, you have money, you pass it on, and you're not just trying to survive, you're trying to excel. I want to have stocks. I want to have bonds. I want to have a lot of money. I want the big house. I want to do better than my dad and my mom did. And it's because living is just the bare minimum. That's just it. I am living. They don't know any different. Yeah. While for us, it's a lot. It's definitely a different step. The ladder for us is different. We're trying to go from surviving to living, to living well, to making sure our kid doesn't have to work and our kid doesn't need a pension. And, you know, and it like pension. When you said that, I'm like, there's people who keep a job that they hate, just so that they can stop working and survive.
Yeah. And never did.
Go ahead.
You know, like I really think I was fortunate. I had a great childhood. We went on vacations. I had, you know, my mother grew up in a home all her life. My grandparents owned several houses and we had a pool when I was a kid in Central Florida. And I never felt any kind of lack, but there was, you know, there was no entrepreneurs in my family. And even still, I struggle with, there is no one I know, I should say, that I trust. I've gotten great advice from, I have very close knit family. I'm close with all of my mother's siblings, my aunts and uncles, and great advice on life and other things, but I've never had an entrepreneur or anybody I could ever just bounce ideas off. Hey, what do you think about if I invest in this? Right. And not only just my inner circle, I would go to friends and like family members. Like I said, I'm close to all of them. So my uncles, my aunts, they all have friends that are close to our family, and my mother's friends and distant cousins. But no one has ever had any of the journey I'm trying to. Like if I needed some marriage advice or, you know, hey, I'm going through this at my job, how should I address this person? They're spot on, great advice. But I've never been able to just bounce the idea, hey, I really want to do this, how should I market this? Or if I do this, is this a good idea? Because everybody's mindset has been, well, you're smart, you've had good jobs before, you work that job until you get it, till you get a pension, or and then that's it. And then, you know, work until you're 65, and then hopefully you have some years to enjoy some of the other stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that. And also, I don't want to, I'm also, when I talk to groups of people, I don't want to say hesitant, but I also don't want to shame anybody that is doing that. There's people that are so happy and have no, you know, maybe if I had was blessed with the job that I really enjoy, like my mother loved teaching. She loved touching the lives of young. She was a special ed teacher for her whole career. Okay. Her vision was, or her goal was, there were so many children that the system said didn't deserve an education because of their disability or because of their, you know, their behavioral problem. And she felt all of those kids deserved. It was their right to have a good education and good educators who supported them. And so she felt purpose and rewarded every single day. And I working, you know, as a PM or a coordinator in my different jobs, I never felt rewarded. So that's the difference too. I don't want to say everybody needs to be entrepreneur. You need to do what makes you feel rewarded.
Right. Right.
Because with some of my endeavors, I have, you know, if Nike called me up and said, "Hey, we want you to do something," I would probably feel rewarded.
Right.
At least I think I would doing this. Or if with my books, I was called upon to write for a bigger publishing company or work with a company that makes textbooks, I would feel rewarded. So it's not so much in the actual, it's in the discipline. It's not the actual company. It's, you know, what's going to reward you.
Right.
And so that's what, and you know, that's what that whole process taught me as well. And what, like I said, what I still struggle with, I still, you know, I live in a day and age now, if I have a question, luckily there's YouTube, there's ChatGPT, there's a podcast for everything. So, you know, the knowledge is there, which is great, but that's, you know, the last 8 years. So,
Life has changed. Life is different. And there's nothing, and like you said, there's nothing wrong with striving for more, wanting more than what you grew up with. It doesn't diminish what you grew up with. It just, you have your own visions, your own ideas of what you want.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible to want more, but to appreciate what was there before. There's nothing wrong with that. So just in case there's anybody who was questioning that, no. I want to do better than my dad. I don't care what he does. Like, he could have been multi-billionaire. I want to be a multi-billionaire plus $1. I want more than him. And that doesn't mean he didn't do well. Because if I have that mindset, if I have that ability to do it, it's because of that. It's because I was raised with that mindset. So I would never, I applaud, you know, respect what we grew up with. And we want to give to our kids.
We want our kids to do better than us.
Exactly. So, that's the way it is. There's nothing wrong with that ever. I want my kids to kick my ass and do better than I've ever done. Please do so.
Unfortunately, statistically, we're headed the other way.
I know.
Because we're about to have the first generation that didn't do as well as their parents. But, you know, we've had a lot. We've had a pandemic, we've had recessions, we've had 9/11, we've had things that, if you were born in the 1950s, outside of course, equality, civil rights, those major things that you didn't face in your 20s and 30s that, you know, the next generation has faced. And so, but like you said, of course, me doing better than them just going to set my children up to do better than me.
Yes.
And that's the ultimate dream. That's why I'm doing all of this. So they will have a better life than I have.
Definitely. Definitely. The next letter in the word prizes are, the word is resilience, the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties and toughness. So I feel like you told us, but I mean, you may have something else. Can you think of a situation, something that happened in life where you had to deal with it, but you found out you had a kind of resilience that you didn't know that you had?
Yeah, I think I'm still dealing with that and still trying to be resilient because there is so many things that I want to do and I've not quite been able to do them. And so it's about being able to wake up and push through every day and not get in my own way, because there's times where I say, you know what, I'm getting older, 40 plus, you know what, maybe I need to just go to the post office because I could get a 20 year and, you know, and be there for 20 years, or maybe I should. And it's, I got to fight. I got to be resilient and fight off those thoughts. Right. Like, I need to do whatever it takes to take care of my family. And I'm not opposed to working somewhere until I achieve my other goals outside of the 9-to-5. But it's that's the hardest thing, is fighting that off. Like, maybe this isn't going to work. Maybe everybody's right. Maybe I'm too, because, you know, and, you know, I fall victim to it too. I have lived in a world before social media, and so that's great, but I still fall victim to, like, man, this kid's 21 years old and a multimillionaire, and whether it's fake or not, and Ferraris, and all because he has an online course and is generating, you know, $14 million a day or whatever it is. So it's, you got to not fall victim to that. I know I have to run my own race, but that's easier said than done, because there's a whole lot of noise out there.
That's
and
true.
That noise can talk you out of your destiny. And like, a lot of times it talks you out of, because it's like, look, you're 40 years old, you haven't accomplished these things, you don't have the big house, you don't have all these things yet, then maybe it's not for you. Because everybody that's 17 years old has those things now. And so you have to be smart enough and resilient enough to fight through those thoughts and not think about that. You got to think about how you run your own race. You got to think about that. A lot of the noise out there is not accurate. It's not the truth. And what I've used to be resilient over this last year, especially because it's been somewhat of a tough year, is trying to implement a lot of gratitude and be as grateful as possible. I have two daughters, 3 and 20 months, and they are healthy, they are smart, they're well cared for. So I have to, you know, they're happy, which is the most important thing. And so we have a nice house, we have roof over our head, everybody eats every single day. So, you know, I have to make sure that I'm grateful of those things and take stock in those things, because so, I realize it's weird, because then there's that guilt that comes along when you feel bad for not being at a certain stage. And then you realize, well, man, I have a house, we have cars, we're able to pay our bills. I mean, maybe a little tight and stressful at times, but we're able to pay our bills. Our kids are happy. We, you know, I live better than 90% of the world. And you have to think about it like that.
Yeah.
And put on a positive face when you're striving towards your goals, because it could be so much different. So, you know, I try to walk that fine line, having gratitude but not feeling guilty, because sometimes I'll feel guilty for feeling bad that I want more, because I'm like, man, how many people don't own their own home? Right. How many people, you know, in Atlanta alone, and Atlanta proper, I think I read the other day, there's 60,000 homeless families, working homeless, I should say, or working poor. So these are people that work 40 plus hours a week and still cannot afford, you know, to have a residence. So, you know, I try to implement a lot of gratitude, but like I said, walk that line, not feel guilty. Like, oh man, I shouldn't strive for more, because I'm already doing better than so many other people. But no, you have to realize that. But then also, you know, that's the enemy trying to take you away from your vision when you start thinking like that.
It's interesting that in a lot, and I know you talk to people, I do the same. And a lot of times our biggest barrier, our biggest enemy, our biggest fight is with ourselves.
Yeah.
We are the reason we aren't succeeding. It's not the business. It's not a competitor. It's not the market. It's me.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to be succeeding. And I talk to people a lot of times, that's it. I get into it. You've got a great idea. You've got the business plan. You've got the market. They're waiting. You have innovation that this world is begging for. Like, you've got it. It's here, but you're holding it. Why? Yeah. And a lot of times it's because I'm not ready. A lot of times there's a lot of stuff that you said, imposter syndrome. Why would somebody buy something from me? Why would somebody listen to me? And if we ever could get past ourselves and just go, success, aplenty, so much money to be made, so much of an impact that we can make, but we have to get past ourselves and this weight. And even you talking about it, guilt, get rid of that guilt. You have every reason to want to strive for success, for big things. You want that big car. You want the two big cars. You want the house with the pool, the indoor pool, all that stuff. We are fighting us so much.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing you talk about it. And I'm like, there's a lot of times, and I've been there and I'm still there at times because I know I can help people. And I know I got this idea and I know I got this stuff. Why haven't I implemented it? Why haven't you implemented it?
Yeah.
If we gain nothing else from just this conversation, anybody who's listening, you have a plan. You have something, a book that you wanted to write, an idea you wanted to put out into the world, a song that you wanted to sing, a poem that you wanted to write. You had something and you got it in a drawer somewhere and you're not doing anything with it, man. I'm mad at you. I'm ready to hear that song, bro. I'm ready to read that book. Put it out there. Take my money. You know what I'm saying? And when we need to bring that. So I hear you saying that a lot. And that is something we have to deal with. We got to fight us.
It is. Yeah. I mean, the Jeff Bezos, the Elon Musk of the world that say, you know what? I want to go to space. And they live in a world where no one has ever said, you know, that's crazy. They're like, okay. And we live in a world where you can go to the moon. You just have to want to. And like you said, where I wrote a book called What Do You Want to Do, as well as the children's book. And I have a chapter about fear, and it's called if you're scared, go to church, like the Drew Down song. And so fear is a great thing. Fear is what keeps you from getting inside a cage with a tiger or walking on a cliff that is dangerous. Like, fear is instinctual. Fear is what makes us up, and fear is good. But a lot of times we just have that fear. What's everybody going to think of me? Or what I face that every day. What are people going to think of me? You know, how are they going to feel? What if it doesn't work? What if I look like a fool? What if I put all this time and effort into it and it still goes nowhere? But, you know, you have to, the one thing that I've realized along this journey that I fear most is mediocrity, and I fear regret. I don't want to, you know, God willing, I got another 40, 50 years on this planet. I don't want to be at that last day and be like, man, I should have just tried my business. Should have did that podcast. I should have asked, you know, closed mouths don't get fed. I should have, you know, that time I had that chance meeting with that person, I should have asked them, you know, what could have happened. I don't want to live that. To me, has to be the scariest thing ever, to die with that inside and have that regret, you know, and expire, leave this world with that regret. That has to be a, like a, that I can't imagine that kind of pain. And so, you know, that's why I'm trying to do the best, tell others we have to get over that fear.
I hear that. I hear that. That's well said. That's really well said. I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize.
Yeah, no.
We walk around with the golden ticket. There'd be nothing worse than just an end of your life and you had the cure to whatever was ailing you and you didn't take advantage of it.
Yeah.
And we need to do that. We need to be motivated. And I like the way you talked about fear. Fear is an important thing. Fear has led to many great innovations. We are alive because somebody was scared of something happening and they did something about it. Yeah. Fear is the great motivator. And, you know, recognizing how to harness it and what to do with it is important. Mm. But I'm scared that my kids are going to have nothing to eat. I have to get that job. I'm scared I'm not going to be able to drive. They're going to come get my car. I have to come up with this idea.
Yeah.
We have to live life with a sense of purpose, with a sense of urgency. We should never, ever. When I talk to men, I always tell them, you know, what do you want to accomplish? Like, what's the end goal? Do you have one? Yeah. And I always suggest that you may want to come up with something. You may have you want to write the book in a particular subject, or be the one who writes that speech that everybody listens to. But I always feel like the end should kind of always just be out of reach, just a little bit. I never want to really succeed at the really thing I want. I should always want to do something else, right? There should always be just the next thing, because I don't want to settle. I don't want to be complacent. I don't want to be, I'm like, all right.
Yeah, it should be big. I was reading another book this week, but they happened to mention Serena Williams, and they said, and like 2004 when she was tied for the most
majors,
most wins,
right,
most major victories. She had 17, and she was tied. Well, I forget who, Steffi Graf or somebody. And they said, and so she lost 3 majors in a row, and her trainer said to her, you know, why? What's? And she's like, I'm just so stressed. I'm trying to get to 18 because 18, and he's like, I'm ashamed that 18 has been your goal this whole time. It's like, you're the best player to ever be on the planet. Your goal should be 30. It should be 40. Should not even thought about 18.
Right.
And when she developed that mindset, it totally changed. And she went on to win 18, 19, 20, all the way up through 25. But it's because, and she said, I realized that your goals need to be a lot bigger, you know, not just the standard quo. I mean, that is a large goal to win that many, but the fact that she was stifling herself because she was worried about just getting that one to just get the record when her potential was so much more than just that one.
Definitely.
And definitely. That's, yeah.
And that's the way we should live in life. That's it. I mean, to a degree, sports is really different because we're trying to catch people. You know, we want to have our legacy. Tiger is that. And sadly, because of his health, he's never going to catch
people.
But to me, he's like 3-4 majors short. But I still think he's the greatest of all time, in my opinion, because he dominated for a while. But we should continue. I'm not looking at the person in front of me. I'm just looking straight ahead. If I happen to pass you, I happen to pass you. That's just what it is. And that kind of competitive nature works in business and how you deal with things. And you stick with that, because I don't think it works in relationships, but I think it works best in business. And I want to succeed, and I want to do it the right way. I want to be remembered for winning the right way, to succeed, to be the best, but as a good person doing it. I want to do it in that moral fashion. I want people to respect my accolades and how I got there. And I think that's an important thing to do. I'm going to keep us moving here. I skip the I. The next letter in the word prize is Z. The word is zeal, enthusiastic devotion. So when I ask men about this one, I do this for really a lot of the reason this podcast is created. We men are here to make sure the lights are on, the car's got gas, the pool is heated, the kids are fed. They got their drink, their snacks, the chips, all that stuff, their gaming systems, the cell phone. We are here to provide for everybody else. What do you do for you? because we rarely are at the top of our list when it comes to taking care. We take care of everybody else. We pull our mask down to make sure we take care of everybody else. What do you do for you, not for your spouse, your family members, your friends, your kids, when life is beating you down, when maybe it's a struggle this month to knock these bills down? When we are struggling, when you are struggling, what do you do for you to deal with life? What is your self-care thing?
My self-care thing is I need some form of motivation. I think Zig Ziglar said, you know, people say, why do you still need motivation? And he's like, well, you took a bath yesterday. You're going to have to take one the next. It wears off. So I find through reading, through podcasts, I need to be stimulated. I need to learn something, because by learning also teaches me that whatever's possible. And so when I'm down and I need that pick me up, it's what podcast am I going to listen to? What book am I going to read? What interview, what TED talk, what can I watch? What can I ingest that I'm going to turn into some kind of fuel? And learning something new gives me, personally, learning something new gives me fuel as well. So okay. I've realized too that I have to be creative, and I've, you know, in creative through business, I want to build. And even if there's things I want to build that I know I can't build tomorrow, planning those out, writing those things down, journaling about those things I want to build gives me fuel, because it helps me look towards the future of what I want to do. And that used to depress me. And now I'm using it, trying to use it as motivation, because before I would look at those ideas and be like, man, how am I ever going to do that? That seems so far out of reach. And it's depressing just to even think about it now. But when I'm journaling and I'm writing and I'm thinking, it's giving me fuel to that. Because a lot of times, like you said, self-care, we're not even allowed that. And like, I've read things like Warren Buffett spends like 6 hours a day reading and going through newspapers. But most of us, can you imagine asking your wife for 6 hours to just read or sit in a room by yourself?
That wouldn't even try.
Yeah. So, you know, I've realized how important those things are. And so that's what gives me motivation and fuel. Even if I just could sneak away an hour, sneak away that while I'm driving for that hour in the car, what podcasts? You know, I have a rotation of podcasts, and you know, most of them are new episodes every week. So if I know I'm going to be in my car 12 hours that week, then I'm like, all right, what 12 am I going to listen to? What book am I going to read? I've set a goal for myself this year to read or listen to 100 new books. Okay. So those things, learning, that's what gives me zeal. That's what excites me. It's not, you know, it's not reality TV. It's not, you know, buying something new. It's what can I learn? Because I want to be able to utilize all these tools for the end goal. So.
I like that. All right. You talked a lot about that, how much you enjoy learning.
Yeah.
But you're also a parent. You've got, you know, 3-year-old, 20-month-old.
Yeah.
I'm a stay-at-home dad of 4. And I love learning too. What do you prefer? Do you like learning or teaching more?
That's tough. Almost equally, but I think I enjoy learning more. I think I enjoy learning more. I mean, teaching is cool. I love when I have an audience. I love when I can share some knowledge. I mean, they're almost equal, but I do enjoy taking in stuff. I enjoy being stimulated by like, oh, I didn't know this. Or when you've read so many different things and then something you were struggling with, something starts to click. Okay, I could take a piece of this and a piece from there. And so, okay, that's how that works. You know, okay. I read lots of autobiographies on people that I would consider, you know, business titans or leaders. So the Ted Turners of the world and those things. And sometimes something that I was, that I'm struggling with, and even though it's not the same industry, or you hear somebody say how they did something that might've been in the mid 70s, 60s, how they did it. But you're like, oh, that was smart. That clicked. Like, that's what makes me feel great. Like, let me try this. I haven't tried this. So learning kind of makes those puzzle pieces fall in line, which, you know, to me is a great, great feeling.
I hear that. I hear that. I like them both. I love school. I loved school. I loved learning. It took me a while to kind of realize I liked it, yeah. But I loved taking stuff in. And I like that. I agree with you with the whole stimulation. Keeps the mind moving and learning and getting better at things and learning new things. And then as a parent, I like then passing it on. So I like the idea of teaching yeah. my son this, teaching my daughters these things. I think when you're teaching, you're learning. When I teach my kids something, how they respond, I'm learning something there.
Yeah.
It's this continuous motion. And I love the idea of it. So I'm always interested to hear people's answer, because in essence, it's the same. It feels like the same. I'm learning.
Yeah.
I'm teaching. I'm learning. It's all a wonderful thing. So I agree entirely with what you said. The last letter in the word prize is E. The word is expectation. Expectation is a strong belief that something will happen or be the case in the future. 5 years from now, what is the headline that I'm going to read about Justin Teal 5 years from now?
So I will say, and you know, this is something else I've struggled with, is when you talk about 5 years from now, is I've always struggled with, not only is this goal too lofty, or I also don't want to sound like a crazy person too. And, or, you know, people are like, you know, you can't, or I don't want to sound like I am all over the place, because I've realized that takes away from your credibility too. When you say, personally, someone comes up to me and says, I'm starting these 9 businesses. I'm like, yeah, whatever. How are you going to do? But I think mine all interconnect, and maybe they're due. So 5 years from now, I would like to have another 10 books published. I've been working on a documentary about my life with vitiligo and other people's life with vitiligo. I would love to, my goal is to have that done within a year, but have that done and have that in households everywhere, and be able to take all those things and teach and educate and travel. I would love to be on the larger stages speaking, okay. TED Talk, being able to talk to the masses and make my living by educating and talking through my books, through my documentary. And I have some other small business ventures that I want to have completed. I would like to be somewhat of a restaurateur. I would like to open a restaurant or two. There's things that I brainstorm and map out. I know they won't happen in the next 2 months, but the way I see it, I see essentially what I tell everybody, you have to become a media company. You have to become your own brand. And so all of these things fit within my wheelhouse and within my brand, the education, the vitiligo, the business. I have a business degree, and also have a degree in film and TV production. And I've worked on that side. I worked on the business side. I've written several books. So I think I'm now giving myself the leeway to say, you know, you are smart enough. You should do these things. Don't feel like, you know, it's not imposter syndrome, because you've done some of these things. So now it's making those things work for me. And that's where I see myself. And a lot of times we feel bad when there's a lot of things we want to do. But like I said earlier, and I keep telling myself, it is that you could do anything you want on this planet. And if throughout your lifetime you want to be the person who opened 10 successful businesses, then do it. You know, you can make it happen.
Yes, sir. Can I just say, as I've just met you. This is the first time we're talking. I would just humbly like to say, do not listen to the people. Forget what they have to say, because it feels that a lot of that is, what are these people going to think of me, blah, blah, blah. And we both know that some of the craziest things, some of the most innovative creations, things that save lives, came from people who thought, who other people thought were crazy.
Yeah.
We are long past the point of like, what are they going to think of me? Forget you. You could think I'm crazy now, and in 2 years, you're going to be reading my book. There is just, we really have to push those people, that noise, all that stuff aside. We have successes. We have things to do. And the last thing we need to avoid, ourselves saying we can't do it and other people telling us we're crazy. You got so much to do. You have so much to do. And when we finally say, forget you, you don't even know what I'm doing. Why would you be concerned? And why would you think I'm crazy? And why should I care? I'm about to do this. And don't worry, you'll be happy about it when it happens. We'll talk then, or maybe we won't. So just for me, because you've done so much, and I actually want to get into what you were talking about. And you mentioned vitiligo. So I would like for you, if possible, you're going to do incredible, you know, in terms of educating people about vitiligo and the books that you've written talking about it. So this is the current thing I feel like we can talk about.
Yeah.
Can I first ask you to kind of tell us about vitiligo? What is it as an illness?
Yeah. So vitiligo is an autoimmune disorder. And essentially it is healthy skin cells, pigment, derma cells, killing off other cells, which leads to the discoloration and the loss of pigment throughout your body. There's no rhyme or reason where it strikes on your body.
Okay.
Normally, if it's on one elbow, it's normally going to be on the other elbow. On one kneecap, it's going to be on the other kneecap. So eventually it starts and kind of convenes in the middle, and you've lost pigment, you know, in all those different places. So I tell people it doesn't hurt. You're a little more sensitive to sunlight, of course, because you don't have the derma. You don't have the pigment that protects you from the UV light. So you will burn, you know, pretty easily. And I'm a little more sensitive to temperature. Like, I feel hot water faster on those areas without pigment than I would on the areas with pigment. Okay. But, you know, like I said, no pain attached. And with vitiligo, the biggest thing is, unfortunately, for the last, you know, there's references to vitiligo from stuff from 3,000 years ago. And most of the time, up until the last two centuries, people thought it was like leprosy. Mm-hmm. But we now know what it is now. It's the same family as rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, because both of those are, if you have lupus, it's the healthy cells in your joints killing off the other cells in your joints, which makes you lose function of joints. And so it's the same thing, but with us, it's just pigment. And so, but unfortunately, it's always been treated as a cosmetic disease. And so I'm trying to be a part of changing that mindset, changing that narrative, because it won't kill you. And that's a great thing, but right. It's a bad thing when it's compared to research. You know, I've, you know, a vitiligo conference you may go to, there's three doctors there that have given their profession, given their professional life to doing it. You go to one on maybe a rare brain cancer that still needs researcher, needs doctors. There might be 150 doctors there, might be more doctors than there are actually people with that are suffering from the thing.
Right.
So
right.
Vitiligo is seen as cosmetic. It's seen as, you know, just deal with it, wear some right. makeup, do, you know, but the mental aspects of it far outseed other things. There mm-hmm. are numbers that show that the rates or the suicide rates with people with vitiligo compared to any other quote unquote disorder or disease are the highest. And so, and the people dealing with the mental anguish, the anxiety of it, of not, you know, wanting to leave their house. So I meet people all the time. And because I've been on some stages, and I last year hosted the World Vitiligo Conference, which travels around the world, but last year was in Atlanta. So I was keynote speaker and hosted that event. And so you meet, you know, I'll be in a grocery store and someone will say, hey, would you get on a Zoom call with my brother? He has vitiligo and he hasn't left his house in 3 years.
Oh, wow.
Or will you come talk to somebody else? And so, you know, I meet men and women all the time that have these stories. And, you know, I've from the very drastic, I met a young woman from India and she got married at 19 or 20. Her vitiligo started at like 24. Mm-hmm. And she was forced to leave her house. She lived with her in-laws and her children. She had three young children, and they essentially said, you have to go. I've met people from, I've met a young lady that was in southern Nigeria, and she was forced to leave her town, her village, essentially, because they, at least the people in her village, just saw it as a curse. And so now a lot of those stories I just mentioned are, of course, other countries. But here, right, in the States or in North America, the Western world, people are, maybe I didn't get that job, or maybe I'm having a hard time finding love or finding a relationship.
Right.
And I meet so many people like that. Or I went on a date with a young woman, and after dating for a while, I got to the point where I disrobed and they, you know, shunned me. Because, you know, there's people that may not have vitiligo in their face, showing their face, but it's on their body and arms, and they can cover that with clothing. And so, you know, it's helping people deal with that. That is my goal within vitiligo and normalizing it. Now, 23 years ago, my vitiligo started. Oh man, it's almost 26 years now. You didn't see it as much in children, and I don't know what's changing in our world. It could be the diet. It could be G5 waves that are, I don't know what it is, but now we see, and we see a lot more children. Now we're seeing children that, if not born with it, within months of being born, have vitiligo. You see toddlers, you see young children. So it's different. Mine, two little spots when I was 17, and then in my mid-20s, it really developed up until this point. And still, even now, I haven't lost 100% pigment. And I know people that developed it in 8 months, they lost 100% of their pigment. So essentially, you went from, especially if you were a darker complexion person, your complete identity changed in 8 months because you look like a completely different person. And so it's helping people like that. It's helping children, because, and that's why I wrote the book, because we see so many children and it's about being able to empower them. Because I know as an adult, if I'm getting questions in the grocery store from other adults that maybe should even know better, imagine what children are getting from other children that have vitiligo.
So true. Yeah. So true. Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot. I had a thought. It left me. I'll get back to it. The only time I've ever heard of vitiligo, obviously, and it's Michael Jackson. That's when I always heard. So, and that was it. And you, actually, now we're escaping. You said that this is a disease that doesn't kill you. And that's a good thing. But we are so superficial.
Yeah.
We are so dependent on how we look and how people perceive us, that if people don't look at us the way we want to, in a way, it kills us.
Yeah.
We are so attached to being attractive, to being wanted, that the idea that this disease, it kind of does, because it affects, it's your self-esteem. You know, this girl won't look at me, or I took my shirt off and something and whatever, or if it's a woman, all this stuff. We are so dependent on the superficial, on the outward appearance, that something that affects it can. And it makes sense. You said that higher rates of suicide because I can't, companionship is, it could be off the table. Yeah. And people are mean. And I can't imagine what it's like being a kid with something like that. Kids are mean in general, and we're just uneducated, and they're just gonna say whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can't imagine that. So that must, so the books that you've written, and it's two of them, I guess one's coming, books for kids about this, I guess, is that what you kind of deal with in these books?
Yeah. So Aiden Spots, I think I have a copy of Aiden Spots. So Aiden Spots is about a young man, his first day kindergarten. Luckily, he has a teacher that's educated in vitiligo, and she's able to walk him and the other students through it to answer all those questions. Does it hurt when you're touched? Well, if I touch you, will I get it? Does it spread? Is it contagious? All of those things. And that's what, and I took questions just from my own personal, when I meet people in the store that ask me the craziest things or just out. So I, you know, when I was going and I spoke at over 100 schools for anti-bullying and other campaigns. And so I very rarely did I meet a child with vitiligo, but once in a while I would, and they would have questions. You know, and I was at the zoo with my children, and a woman came up to me and she said, "Hey, would you mind speaking to my 7-year-old daughter? She has vitiligo and she's here." And so I walked over and spoke to her, and she said, "You know, she's never seen anybody else in person that has vitiligo like her." Right. And so representation matters so much. So if you're, you know, better than anything else I could get with this book, the best reward I've gotten with the book so far is a woman who wrote in and said, after receiving the book, she said, my third grade son, so I'm assuming like 7, 8, mm-hmm. Brought to school. And when they have their reading time, the teacher read the book to the whole class. And she said that she's seen a change in him since the day they read the book. Because it answered questions he didn't know how to answer. And he, you know, since reading the book, it has stopped some of the questions that he was getting from his classmates and empowered him with knowing a little bit like, no, it's autoimmune, it's not contagious, knowing those things. And so if that's a reward enough with just one person, so if we can get other kids from around the world to feel that same way and give them some empowerment, that's the ultimate goal with this.
That's good. And that's wonderful. You're doing big things in this world. One last question about vitiligo. And I don't know, I've never really investigated or gone into it. You say it's autoimmune disease, but is it genetic?
It's, unfortunately, the jury's still out on that. So a lot of people say it is genetic. And a lot of times you can trace someone in your family. I personally have not, but I know some of the other people with vitiligo that can trace it to someone in their family, a grandparent, a great aunt. So we have to assume it's genetic, but at the same time, when that query comes up, people say, well, lupus and other things, Crohn's disease, they're not genetic, and right. They still are affecting the same way. So the jury's still out. Stay on that, and so we really don't know. But to touch on something else you said, you're educated in the fact that you said, isn't that what Michael Jackson has? Because probably 80% of the world thinks he just dyed his skin or
right.
And so, you know, I can't speak to the plastic surgery, but I know there's photographic proof, and there's proof from doctors that have come out that treated him, dermatologists that, yeah, he clearly had vitiligo, and unfortunately he was the most seen person in the world at that time. And so I can only imagine how you deal with that. And right. So, you know, my documentary discusses some of that, you know, Michael Jackson, that's why we got the Billie Jean performance with the one glove. Cause the vitiligo started on his right hand and he wanted to cover it for that performance and not cover it with makeup. And so, that's what the option was, and then it came on the wearing the tape on the fingers was the cover to vitiligo on his knuckles. And so, you know, all these little things that now are come evidence and people have spoke on, because I'm sure he asked people not to say why he was doing these things.
Right.
But, you know, so it's to bring light to that, because unfortunately, and you get average folks that I run into that are asked that same question. Well, why would you want to dye your skin? Are you trying to be white? And you're like, no, I have autoimmune disorder. I have, yeah, whatever. We know you're dying your skin. Right. Yeah. So,
yeah, he went through so much. I'm huge fan, so I knew a little bit about that. And like, he was a star, so obviously, and then there's so many factors. Vitiligo was like one thing, but it was like a jumping off point for us to judge him for so many other things. Well, he has this, so he's going to deal with it the way he's comfortable. Yeah. But it just fits into the thing of, you know, Michael before he was black, or when he became white, and all these things. And it starts all these other conversations, real disrespectful stuff to a man. Like, that's his health and that's his business.
Yeah.
And when it happened and he protected himself because he didn't know how the world would deal with it, if he was around now, if he was in this star making journey that he was back then in the 70s and 80s, now, because we're so just accepting and listening, it would have been like, oh, I have vitiligo. Oh, okay. We'd have learned about it. They'd have done a movie. He'd have done a telethon. And then we'd have moved on with the day. But he's going through it as the biggest star on the planet.
Yeah.
And everybody's looking at him. Everybody's looking at him. And he has to look good all the time. And he grew up in a tough time. And it's amazing. Illness is not just one thing. It's just the tipping point. There's so much more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
and terrible. Like you said, we all want to be accepted. It's all about our looks. And we're average. We're maybe on Instagram. He had the whole world before social media, and he was still, the whole world knew his every move. And you know, so that I can't imagine that is, yeah.
Because we're in this zone where, like, every once in a while a star comes along, somebody really big, and like, oh, they're as big as Michael. And then they'll say that with Taylor Swift and all these people. And I'm a massive Michael Jackson fan. I laugh when I see stuff like that. Sure. If there was social media when Michael Jackson was walking the streets, like, he couldn't leave the house.
Yeah.
Nothing. These people are stars with social media. Michael was this level of star, and you didn't have social media.
Yeah.
He was that epic. He's still that epic when people are comparing other stars to him, and he's not even with us anymore.
No, he still gets more streams and sells more albums than most stars weekly today.
Yeah, he's the one. The one. We're comparing to him. Yeah. But let's go back to prize. So I is the last letter in the word prize, and it doesn't represent a word, but it represents you. Let's take away all the shackles. So you're not a husband, a father, a businessman, a speaker, a survivor of vitiligo. I mean, everybody is a survivor of vitiligo, all that stuff. When it's all that stuff is taken away and it's just you, at your core, who are you?
I'm the guy that just wants to help other people. You know, that's it. I solely believe if I help enough other people, then what I want is going to work out. And so that's what I try to do, try to leave the world, try to leave everybody I meet better off than they were before I met them.
I like that. That's a good way to go. We have had a wonderful conversation. Where can people find you? Social media, website, what's going on with you?
Yeah, so I go by The Grindpreneur. So you can find me in all social media at Grindpreneur, GINDPRENEUR. They're very good. There, y'all see it now. The Grindpreneur and all social media. Aiden Spots can be purchased on spottedskin.com. And the other book, Daddy Skin, will be released quite soon, and you can purchase that as well. Daddy Skin essentially is, from the other perspective, a father with vitiligo talking to his young child and their friends. And essentially, my daughters have not asked me yet. The oldest is 3, and I'm just daddy, but I know that day is coming, and it probably will be, and probably won't even be from her, it'll be from another friend who says something, or another child that says something to her that sparks her interest that dad is a little bit different. So Daddy Skin is quite soon. And both of those, like I said, can be purchased on Spotted Skin, as well as you can look up Aiden Spots on Amazon.com. So you can go through us or go through Amazon to get it. And so, yeah, everything will be found there. Hopefully, starting the speaking circuit again, starting in March. So hopefully I'll soon be at a city near you to come out and see me. I'll talk about what do you want to do? You know, the easiest hard question you'll ever have to ask yourself, and trying to get to that, what's your purpose? And I also speak on one of my other, I do a service called The Power of Telling Your Story, and how telling your story can be profitable, can be not only profitable, but cathartic to help you work through whatever you're working through. But how can you feed your family by telling your own story? So hopefully you guys will see me soon on some of those.
Okay. All that information, in case you didn't get, weren't able to write it down, will be in the episode notes.
Awesome.
Mr. Hall, I appreciate it. Thanks for telling us. This felt like a good, just good positive conversation, just like head on positivity. What we going to do? This is the kind of conversation I like, you know, feeling low, come back up. Success is here. We got big things to come. You obviously have big things to come, and I appreciate you giving me of your time. I tell, and I usually do this afterwards, but I will say this to you, every person that I'm lucky enough to have on the podcast and speak to, I consider a friend that I've made. So we have each other's information. You have mine. Anytime you want to holler and talk, when the book's coming out, when you're speaking something, if you have anything you want to talk about, anything that's going on in 5 years, we're going to get back on here. And we're going to have a whole new bio to read. But nonetheless, I'm here for anything that you may ask. Anything I can do to help, feel free to reach out to me. Thank you so much for talking.
I appreciate it. Pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no problem at all. Let's put you back here for a second. Hang on. Another fantastic episode. Justin T. Hall was great. And we got into some real positivity here. So I'm going to talk to you about this. Thanks for watching and listening to this episode. But I want you to take what we said to heart here. You have a song that we've been waiting to hear. You've got the great novel in your head. You've got the great poem that we need to hear. You've got innovation that the world is waiting for. You, and the only thing stopping you from putting it out there is you. Because let's get rid of the imposter syndrome. What you know, what you're going to do is important. You are valuable. We want to hear from you. Don't worry about what those other people say, the haters and whatever. We don't have time for that. Those people don't pay your bills. Those people don't raise your kids. You do. You have so much to give us. So give it to us. We want it. Bring it here. To all the men, everybody who's listening and watching, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening to me and any guest. Justin was fantastic today. As a reminder, if life is kicking your butt, if life is tough, if we are struggling, if you're at the lowest of the low, remember, if you were at the lowest of the low, you're coming back up. Somebody doesn't really know that you're struggling. All they know is that they're so happy because you're coming into work tomorrow, or that you're going to call them, or they're going to see you and they're going to laugh with you, or they're going to debate something with you. They're going to spend time with you. You make somebody's day better. You don't even know it, but you do. So you have to keep coming back. You have to show up every time. So show up. Because we need you. And why do we need you? Because you are a wonderful man. You are a great person. And you're the prize. I'll see you next week.